Welcome to the Kindlings Muse podcast, an intelligent, imaginative, hospitable exploration of ideas that matter in contemporary life. And now, here's your host, Dick Staub.
Welcome back, everybody. This is Dick Staub. You're listening to the Kindlings Muse. Tonight, we're talking about the New Atheists, a fascinating article in Wired Magazine. If you'd like to read it, go to thekindlings.com. And there you can find this podcast posted and links to the article and also a chance for you to post your comments as listeners around the world to this subject. We're joined now in this second segment, having enjoyed conversation with Adrian Wired, by John West, who is from the Discovery Institute. And John, great to have you with us tonight. Let's have
good
a big hand, a round of applause for John West.
Thanks for having me.
I know it's been a very, very busy day for you, Darwin's birthday, and you've been doing a lot of media, and you wrote a piece on National Review Online today about it, and you've been very, very active in this campaign. How did this become an important issue to you, John?
Well, you know, I had always been interested in the interface between science and public policy, and I think troubled by some of the misuses of science to claim that human beings were nothing more than sort of genes and heredity, and that we didn't have personal responsibility, and sort of giving a really truncated view of human beings. Sort of what C.S. Lewis wrote about in his book, The Abolition of Man, which is still one of my favorite books. And so I've always been troubled by that. And then in the mid-early 1990s, read an article in the Wall Street Journal by a young philosopher of science named Steve Meyer that was talking about a biologist from a state university in California who was being actually prevented from teaching his biology courses, and he had an academic freedom complaint all the way up to the faculty senate. And his heresy was that he had been a biologist who had really been committed to Darwinian theory, but in really the 1980s had come to the conclusion that there was some evidence for the design, sort of intelligent design in nature, and would tell students that. And that was the heresy that at a state university, a tenured biologist who actually had helped publish a key textbook in the area of chemical origins of life, his name was Dean Kenyon, got him. That was the dangerous thought. That was the dangerous idea, far more than Darwin's idea. It's interesting, Dennett has this book called Darwin's Dangerous Idea, but this idea of intelligent design, really was a dangerous idea, and his academic freedom was on the line. And so we invited Steve Meyer out to give a summer talk, and he really talked about a whole new generation of postdocs who were just coming out of philosophy of science programs, biochemistry programs, physics programs, who on the basis of empirical sort of modern science were saying that this idea, sort of the Darwinian idea, that the appearance of design that you see in nature, this is sort of Dawkins' sort of main points in some of his earlier books, you know, throughout nature it looks like it's designed, but Darwin helped us understand why that appearance of design doesn't have to be real design. Well, these scientists and philosophers of science were saying, in fact, what they're finding is that, no, you need genuine design. And on the basis of science, not on the basis of the religious beliefs, say someone like biochemist Michael Behe, who I've become friends with over the past decade, he was a Roman Catholic when he was a Darwinist. And what really intrigued him was reading a book by Michael Denton called Evolution of Theory and Crisis, and seeing how it matched things that he was looking in the laboratory, and he was fascinated. So he didn't come to this conclusion because his religious beliefs changed. He didn't have some new conversion to Catholicism. He was a Catholic before and after. And so this really intrigued me and some others at Discovery Institute, Bruce Chapman, that number one, you could have this based on science, and that you had this academic freedom issue. You know, we thought universities were supposed to be a place where you could have a robust exchange of ideas. And the fact that this was the dangerous thought you weren't allowed to pursue, that really troubled us. And that's really how we got involved into it, because Discovery, when it was founded, was really dealing with technology and public policy and a lot of other things.
It's very weird, but I was at King Broadcasting when Bruce moved out here, and I interviewed him about the Discovery Institute way back then, before it was at all involved in this issue, just because I thought it was fascinating that some group was moving to Seattle to do this kind of work. When you have listened to Adrian, and we've very, very kind of superficially skimmed the surface of these three books, what are some of the things that you would add to the kind of the arguments that these new atheists are raising?
Three thoughts that I'll just sort of just put into stirrup the mix. One, I'd challenge the idea that there's really anything fundamentally new here. I'd agree with, I think, the guest that you said what's wrong with old atheism. I wouldn't quite say that, but I say this new atheism really is the same that we've had for the past 100 years, really. And even going back further, if you go back to the 18th century, to people like Lemaître and others in France, some of the hardcore sort of scientific materialists, you have had people who have tried to use science or misuse science to make sort of the claim for atheism for, you know, hundreds of years. And within the past 100 years, particularly since sort of post-Darwin, this has been sort of a growth industry. And in American culture, anyone, you know, people like Madeleine Murray O'Hare or, you know, Marxism, Leninism, the whole idea of founding a, you know, political system based on sort of scientific atheism, all sorts of intellectuals who have claimed that you can refute God or that science really refutes that. So I'm having a hard time finding anything fundamentally new. Yeah, Dawkins is certainly in your face, but there have been a lot of in your face people before. And it certainly is a distinction between those who don't want to be as offensive as he is, but there have been lots of people like Dawkins. So that's point one. Second thought is I think we make it too easy when we try to paint Dawkins as so extreme that, you know, there's something that he's sort of out there on the fringe. There's a lot of evidence. I mean, if you go around and see the celebrations today on Darwin Day, like Evolution Palooza down in San Francisco, sponsored by the San Francisco Atheists, or any of the number of things, some where they sing Christmas carols to tunes of, you know, mocking that. One of my favorites is randomness is good enough for me. If there's no design, it means I'm free. You can pray to go to heaven. I'm going to try to roll a seven. Randomness is good enough for
me. Now, what Christmas carol is that sung to?
Well, that actually isn't sung to a Christmas carol. That's sung to a gospel-type music by a group called Scientific Gospel Productions that sort of mocks gospel music. My point is that there is a whole subculture, I almost want to call it Darwinian subculture, that is a lot broader than just Dawkins. And let me just give one, and then I'll go on to my third point, but one statistic. The National Academy of Sciences, sort of the elite, most elite scientists in America, there was a survey, a standard, you know, survey in 1998 of the scientists of National Academy of Sciences. Of the biologists, 95%, or I think 94.4%, describe themselves or identify themselves as atheists or agnostics. Now, that's almost the complete inverse of the general population, where more than 90% describe themselves as theists. And actually, it turns out there were more theists among other disciplines, like in physics and mathematics. But in biologists, you had about 95% among the nation's most elite biologists. Well, why is that? Well, it's not just because, you know, Dawkins' view is just out there on the fringe. So that's sort of the second thing to stir the pot. And then finally, I do think this whole discussion of Dawkins, not tonight but more broadly, and Dennett, and how they're treated by the news media and sort of in the general sort of cultural conversation, really exposes an important double standard. Say someone like Eugenie Scott at the National Center for Science Education, who counts Dawkins as a supporter, but will not say, you know, she won't go along with some of his public agenda, even though her private views are similar. But she won't say, well, he's not a scientist because he's making those views, and we shouldn't listen to him because he's just an atheist. In fact, she'll say, you know, he knows what he's talking about with the science. Well, turn it around. How many times have I heard say biochemist Michael Behe, because he's a Roman Catholic, whatever he says about science is suspect, and that in and of itself is a refutation. Oh, he's a Roman Catholic, or Stephen Meyer is, you know, a Presbyterian. Oh, you know, as if that's a crime, and that's sort of a refutation. And there's a real double standard, I think, in our culture, that if you're a person of faith, that sort of is an immediate put down for, well, whatever you say after that must not be true. But I don't see a lot of people saying that about Dawkins' views about evolutionary biology. And actually, I agree with that, by the way. I think that Dawkins' views on evolutionary biology should be refuted based on the evidence, not on his religious or lack of religious beliefs. But what I find that it really strange or illuminating is that we don't have a similar standard that's applied to people of faith who, say, embrace something like intelligent design.
Let me raise what I think a couple of the arguments are in these three authors and see where the two of you would, how you would comment on them. The first is the idea that belief in religion itself, and I do think this is a rather new argument, is genetically wired. that religion, and I think this is Harris's, I'm not sure whether this is Dawkins, but that the religion is a vestige of our primitive nature, that it's tribal and it's dangerous. That, yeah, we're genetically wired towards religion. It's explaining why 95% of the public are still theists, because we're wired that way. But it's something that we should be resisting because it's outlived its kind of usefulness. Would you say that's one of the arguments that runs through at least one or two of these books?
Sure, Adrian? Sure.
And what's wrong with that and what's right about that?
Well, at one level, there's nothing wrong with it because trying to understand phenomenon is going to be helpful. I think where this gets confusing is that both Dawkins and Dennett think that they are pretty close to a complete understanding of the phenomenon of religion. And it comes from this extreme confidence in science as being competent throughout all domains of knowledge. And so on the one level, I would say, you know, I think there's a lot we can learn. There's some very interesting ideas as to what leads people to be religious. Perhaps there is some genetic component. Yeah. Some people are much more susceptible to hypnotism than others. Maybe there's some kind of connection there. I think that's very interesting. But the question is, once you've got sometime in the future, because it's not now, you've got some very detailed scientific understanding of the phenomenon of belief, what does that say about the wider actual claims of that religion?
How much of our problem is that interdisciplinary discourse is virtually impossible given specialization today. I mean, what you just said about Dennett and Dawkins have this great confidence in their understanding of religion, when in fact, when you read their stuff, you know, it's like a Sunday school level understanding of religion. Whereas on the other hand, you have people who are very deeply religious who have a deep comprehension of religion, but have very little real understanding of science. So they're really incapable of engaging the dialogue of science. So that you essentially, and I interviewed the guy, I'm sorry, I forgot his name, from Flock of Dodos.
Randy Olson.
Randy Olson. If any of you have not seen this documentary, need to see Flock of Dodos. To me, one of the things that became obvious in that movie was the inability of people on every side of this issue to really understand what the other side is saying. And I think Randy was a little taken back when I talked about the arrogance of the scientists at the poker table. That they were actually raising these ad hominem arguments about religious people burned at the stake and so forth, instead of talking about the science.
It's incorrect as well, of course.
Yeah, right, exactly. Whereas Michael B. was talking about the science. And so there's this ships passing in the night in this discussion. Can we really, if what is needed is a more robust interface and interaction honestly with each other, is it even possible anymore?
You know, it is possible, and I don't want to stop you in terms of your enthusiasm for seeing that happen, but it does happen. The trouble is it's quite dull. I am very proud to be connected to a group down in Berkeley called the Center for Theology and the Natural Sciences, and have been for a very long time. Fascinating people. Often they have two PhDs. These are the people you need to talk to. But I tell you, it's tough to talk to them. They live on a different plane. And this is essentially the goal that I've given to Counterbalance, is try and take that dialogue, which is not necessarily tied up with trying to gain approval from a group of supporters, but has the time to spend the next decade talking about something that might turn out to be rubbish, that has this freedom. And it does happen in a little bit, it could happen a whole lot more, in the university system. When they come out with something useful, how does that reach the public? And that's where Counterbalance tries to step in.
But I think what you're talking about is academics talking to academics being boring. And one of
on the way, on the way to
their
conclusion.
Yeah, but one of the articles that I read said that if you, as a scientist, can't sit down at the bar with a typical person and explain your position, then you haven't done your job as a scientist. Which was one of the points of the Dodos movie, was that the scientific community, on the evolutionist side, has done a terrible job of communicating what they believe, not even showing up at hearings because they believe they don't need to because they hold the truth.
But I think that there's a deeper problem that I don't think we should gloss over, which is there's a lot of work being done on sort of interdisciplinary, but one of the problems is the heart of modern science for people like Dawkins is a very monistic view that everything has to go back to matter and energy. And so they want interdisciplinary, but it's, well, I don't know if any of you read the book, Consilience by E.O. Wilson a few years ago, which was the rage actually in the humanities. And what was consilience? Well, we need this broad unifying strand that ties things together and basically is this materialist worldview that everything goes back to matter and energy that sucks everything into it. And so, you know, one of the troubles is if you conceptualize science where mind really is just a product of matter, you really can't have anything else. I mean, really, you know, unless you are open to a view of science where mind is something that's irreducible in and of itself, but and that you think that you can reduce everything to matter and motion, then really all the other disciplines don't have any dignity, you know, really to participate in the conversation.
Well, that's recognizing that this problem could be much larger. I think there's a big enough problem if you just talk about the disciplines that exist in a regular university, or if you're talking about moving beyond the sort of a physicalist understanding. I'd like to touch a little bit on the communication side, because I think more than anything, I just like to put in a little cheerleading session for teachers. It is true, especially the main thrust of the film, the Flock of Dodos film, is recognizing what a lousy job that many public teachers of evolution do. They come across as arrogant and simplistic, and they have no time for ordinary people because they're superior. However, as much as I'd like to see all energy possible go into improving communications to the general audience, we need to recognize that some parts of science, and this is basically refuting the claim that you can do it at a bar, quantum mechanics is never going to be easy to explain at a bar.
What the bleep is it?
Even calculators.
What was the name of that movie?
What the bleep, yeah. Sure. There is a need for that bleep at the bar. You know, it's going to be true. And what is also true is that what Dawkins, Dennett, and Harris don't realize is that there's a great deal of richness in theological and technical theology that is hard to communicate. And when they don't get it, it doesn't mean we're stupid. It means they need to go and read their textbooks.
But yeah, go ahead.
But I was going to say to be able to have a genuine discussion like we are having, which thankful that you're holding it, you really need to have a respectful discussion where people have their own views heard. And I'll be the sort of dissenter about Flock of Dodos, which I find a very actually
And I saw Fraud of Dodos, too, the online version that you guys did.
Yeah, you could go to hoaxofdodos.com and see some of the things that we think are wrong with it. But that's hoaxofdodos.com.
flockofdodos.com while you're at it.
That's true. My point is that, in fact, that Randy Olson's film, by the time you get to the end of it, I think it's actually very manipulative and really doesn't allow people like Michael Behe or Jonathan Wells or John Angus Campbell or others to actually speak for themselves. And he takes some really manipulative shots that actually are completely false. And one of the cases now has sort of publicly admitted that part of his attack on Jonathan Wells was wrong. But my larger point there is that how do you have a genuine discussion if that's held up as, like, a Flock of Dodos is held up as a good interface between, you know, intelligent design and evolution, when it really, from my view, isn't. I mean, how my point is to get a genuine interchange is that means you have to have forums where people who are passionate and intelligent believers in their case are able to present it and interact and not be edited out in a way that sort of makes just the point of a documentary filmmaker.
Urging people to see Flock of Dodos is for the same reason that when I went to Sundance and saw For the Bible Tells Me So and Save Me, two films made by the gay community reaching out to Christians, I advocate people going and seeing them. There are certainly these pieces of work that are trying to be in this bridging ground end up having a bias, because we all do. But I think at least they're useful for stimulating some discussion and some debate.
Oh, I agree with that.
And I want to come back to this is a comment. And by the way, I found it really interesting that Gary Wolf, because the writer of the Wired article, takes the position, I'm out in search of truth. I want to find out whether I should be an atheist or not. And I'm kind of looking for the ground of all being somewhere. And so he ends up going through Dawkins, and he ends up going through Harris, and then he ends up with Dennett. And Dennett, by the way, takes the position that we should all study religion, every religion in public school. Because if we really studied religion, we'd all abandon religion. because we'd realize how foolish it all is. But most of us, he said, are kind of cocooned in our own religion. I mean, how many times have I looked at a young man from India who's Hindu and asked myself, if I was born in India, would I be Hindu? I mean, I'm Christian because I was raised in this country in a system that supported that and kind of affirmed it. And then you reach a place where you have to make an independent decision. But making independent decisions in modern society is very difficult to do because we're all squeezed into conformity. Meanwhile, back at Dennett and his argument that we should all study religion, he's saying if we studied other religions, we'd see similarities and dissimilarities. I mean, a basic course in world religions would be really useful for all of us. You know, if we think about the conflict right now between Islam and Christianity in the world. But here is a quote from Francis Collins, who I had a chance to interview and meet last summer. Francis Collins has this sentence, "Nothing in science prohibits belief." And then Wolf goes on to say, but science is dismantling belief. Now I want the two of you to react to this. When secular investigations take the lead, sacred doctrines collapse. There's barely a field of modern research. Cosmology, biology, archaeology, anthropology, psychology, in which competing religious explanations have survived unscathed. When it comes to concrete examples of exactly what we should believe, reason is a slippery slope, and at the bottom is atheism. So he's essentially arguing that science in his march through history is discipline by discipline, dismantling what religious people have believed in each of those disciplines. Do you agree with that or not?
I think it's the exact opposite. And I think that they're talking about science. They're stuck 100 years ago, as if before anyone talked about the Big Bang, before the fine-tuning of the physical constants of the universe, before we actually understood that at the heart of things like DNA is tremendous information content of the type that makes the largest supercomputer in the world look puny by comparison. And so to think that if you go back 100 years and look at these old materialist explanations, they're very similar to the ones you see today, but more simplistic, that, we just now understand that if you just have enough time and chance and necessity and you put it all together, you can get what we have, is just absolutely preposterous. And that's, for me, what was so intriguing in the mid-90s when I first got to know people like Michael Behe or Stephen Meyer or mathematician Bill Dembski. These are bright people, in many cases with double PhDs, and in fact have been attacked for, I think Bill Dembski has been attacked for actually having multiple PhDs, and also a degree in theology, as if there's some crime for that. But I think that, I think in fact the exact opposite, that this whole, the materialist superstition, what George Gilder used to call the materialist superstition, that matter and energy on its own can really come up with us, and beauty and truth really has, I think, if anything, been disproved. And just think on one thing, the idea of the Big Bang, which, interestingly enough, at the time it was originally proposed, was rejected by a number of scientists because they thought that it had theistic implications. The idea that you have an absolute beginning point, what was before the Big Bang? I mean, it really had some strong theistic implications, and they rejected it because of that, but came to see otherwise. So I think there's a good case of actually something in recent science over the past several decades that does the exact opposite. And I think same thing in genetics. Again, when you find at the heart of genetics this DNA, this huge information content, which really traditional neo-Darwinism, I think, has a very hard time explaining how you get the huge information content that actually programs the cells to begin with from a process of chance and necessity and mutations. So I think it's the exact opposite.
I think there are a couple of dimensions here, and both of them are kind of tricky. The first one is recognizing how complex the notion of belief and the actions that surround being a believer can involve. The way that our writers tonight have defined it, it's just basically being gullible. If you're gullible, then you're a person of faith, and being skeptical is smart. But you know, if we had time, I think we'd really want to tease that down. But one little way of putting it is, I mean, there are occasions to be skeptical. If you were to tell me there's a pink elephant flying outside the window, I'm going to doubt it, and I'm right to do so. But I guarantee you I'm right. But if your son comes to you and says, I believe I can win first prize in this science fair, you would be right to not be skeptical at this point. You know, there's reason to doubt, but in a point of fact, the language that we'd like to use is, you know, I believe in you, son. And there's a reason you do that. There is this notion of reasoned faith. And boy, that would be worth talking about a whole lot more. But I think the other dimension is really key, which is essentially a continuation of what John was talking about here. There is this basic assumption within our writers, and I think generally speaking, within the scientific community, that the more we know about the natural world, the more doubtful it is that there is a God with any kind of role to play, and ultimately it becomes vanishingly small. And there is an assumption there, and I just want to name it as an assumption, that the this gets to the idea that maybe matter and energy, surely matter and energy can't be all there is. Matter and energy is all that we really get to describe with the eyes of science. Information really expressed as structure and organization, the stuff that shows up in like the basic equations, the stuff that you can touch and feel and has an effect at the small scales is matter and energy. And the question is, what is the world that we live in seamless? And could it be that if God is indeed responsible for creating this universe, what if he chose to make a seamless creation? And then the eyes of science, pretty much as we conceive them now, not requiring a new vision of science that we have from the Discovery Institute, what if the basic tools that science deploys now can see some large way into the way nature works? Will that be the end of any kind of role for God? And that's a really tough question, and the answer is technically no. So we should be aware of that. Maybe God is acting throughout the whole system.
John?
Well, I'm trying to process how that intersects with, I guess you mentioned Discovery Institute. I'm not sure that accurately.
I'll talk about John West then. I mean, you were saying that basically information and all mind, science when properly conceived will include this notion of mind as a foundational element. That's the way I understand the position. And that's a radically re-envisioned science.
I think that's radical, only in terms of 19th century sort of materialism. I'd say that science should go where the evidence leads, and if it turns out, I mean, I think it's also a practical question. I mean, if you think, and it gets to how you view human beings in medicine, for example. I mean, it has really practical implications. If you think that you sort of have an exhaustive description of reality, or that all you can do through science, properly speaking, is treat people as matter and energy, I think that is. I think that poses problems for science. I think it does pose problems for traditional theism. I would say someone like C.S. Lewis, who I would cite because I think he had a lot of sense, really stood in the stream of an older view that faith is reasonable. And that one of the ways that you see this is what Protestants would call general revelation or Catholics call natural law. It was the idea that you actually could, through your reason, see things in the world that actually point toward God. Yeah, and you find this in both Jewish and Christian theology traditionally. And really, I think the view, as I understand it, that Adrian, you're talking about, is something that you find, say, in Ken Miller's book, Finding Darwin's God, or John Hout a little bit, or some others, that you can't, that we can't say that we can discern anything from the real world. We can't really look and see design in the real world really seriously.
Actually, I disagree.
So the world looks as if it's not. In other words, the world looks like it's not design. I think that poses really problems for sort of traditional theology.
It's
a surprise to all of us that we haven't resolved all these issues thus far. But we're now going to go to our audience and take their questions, and each of our guests will get a chance to make some concluding comments. This is Dick Staub. You're listening to the Kindling's Muse. We'll be right back.